Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, May 6th, 2022. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you. Free of corporate influence. This week on the show, we feature an interview with Natalie Mera, the Executive Director of the Ontario Health Coalition. The Ontario Health Coalition is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest activist coalition and network. The coalition is a network of grassroots community organizations, nurses and health professionals organizations, and more. The coalition works to protect the health system from threats like cuts, delisting, and privatization. This is partly done by raising public awareness about Ontario's current healthcare system's programs and services, including long-term care homes. During the height of COVID-19, the average death rate in these private for-profit care homes was 5.7%. Compare that to non-profit long-term care homes, which saw 2.8%, lower again at 1.4% for municipal facilities. Currently, 60% of Ontario's long-term care homes are private for-profit, and despite these private care homes being notoriously understaffed, failing inspections, and responsible for the deaths of thousands of Canadians during COVID-19, the Ford government has just issued 30-year licenses and expansions for 18,000 additional LTC beds. All the while, public funding for healthcare in Ontario is the lowest in the country. Ahead of the Ontario election, Mera is hoping the privatization of the province's long-term care homes becomes a key issue. Speaking with Mera is Rabble contributor Doreen Nickel. Nickel is a social activist, freelance writer, and frequent contributor to Rabble.ca. In 2016, she won the Hamilton Independent Media Award for Social Justice and Human Rights. Here are Nickel and Mera in conversation. Take a listen.
Welcome to Rabble Radio, Natalie. I'm so glad you could join us to talk about personal health care in Ontario.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why don't you tell us a bit about Ontario Health Coalition, specifically why it exists, its mandates, and its membership?
Well, we were formed way back before the Canada Health Act came in, and our job is to protect single-tier public health care for all. So under the principles of what became the Canada Health Act, sort of principles of compassion and equity, that healthcare should be based on people's need and not how wealthy they are. And over the years, as restructuring and cuts and privatization become major issues, we have fought to protect public health services, to improve those services for people, to make them more responsive to communities, to stop privatization and cuts and closures of local healthcare services. And we've done that quite successfully, actually, across Ontario. We have about 750,000 people that we represent in our membership, and approximately 30 to 50 local healthcare coalitions, local chapters across the province where people volunteer to help in their local communities. So we're kind of like a public watchdog for healthcare in the public interest.
On February 1st of this year, Ontario Health Minister Christine Elliott announced that independent health clinics were going to operate private clinics in Ontario. She cited the need to clear backlogs, specifically citing pediatric surgeries and cancer screenings. But since that announcement, I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said Christine Elliott did not say private hospitals could operate in Ontario. In fact, these same people claim that privatization of the healthcare system is not happening in Ontario in any way, any shape, or any form. Could you maybe help clarify exactly what Christine Elliott did say in that announcement?
So February 1st, Doug Ford held a press conference. They were announcing the reopening of surgeries and diagnostics in order to clear, well, just to reopen them, but also to clear the backlogs created from their closure during that the last wave of the pandemic. And in the press conference, the Minister of Health, Christine Elliott, said, We're going to open pediatric surgeries and so on. That means in our public hospitals. And she said, and we're going to make sure we allow independent health facilities to operate private hospitals. That's a direct quote. That's on TV. It's on video. That's what she said. So there's no sort of denying what she said. Independent health facilities are what the private for-profit clinics are called in Ontario. So what she said was, we're going to make sure we allow the private clinics to operate private hospitals. But private hospitals are banned in Ontario and have been since the inception, really, of the public hospital system, since, you know, the early 1970s, sort of a year after OHIP was created. The Private Hospitals Act was amended, and it bans any future private hospitals. We pointed that out right away, and ever since, the government has been backtracking. But that is not the only place where they've said that their intention is, and in fact, where they have actually financed the expansion of private clinics to take over more surgeries and diagnostics from our public hospitals. And so in the pandemic plan, the written pandemic plan of the Ford government, they said that it was their intention to do that. They, again, couched in euphemisms, they said they're going to use alternate care facilities to do it. In the leaked version of that document, just a couple of weeks before that document was released publicly, they used the words independent health facilities, which are the private clinics in Ontario. In the summertime, they actually gave funding for, I think it was around $24 million to the independent health facilities, the private clinics, to expand privatized surgeries and diagnostics. So there's no real possibility of claiming that they're not doing it or that they didn't intend to do it. I'm happy to see that they're backtracking when called on it, but that does not mean that they haven't already funded an expansion, but in their own words, of the private clinics. And of course, private clinics providing surgeries and diagnostics is privatizing public hospitals. It's having clinics operate as private for-profit hospitals, providing what are currently public hospital services. That is just the latest in a whole array of unprecedented privatization of healthcare that the Ford government has been engaging in.
Let's talk about long-term care homes. Currently, 60% of long-term care homes are private for-profit. The average death rates in the private for-profit facilities during COVID was 5.7%. If you compare that to nonprofits, which had 2.8% and 1.4% for municipal facilities, it's pretty staggering that the private for-profit was so high. Yet conservatives just issued 30-year licenses and expansions for 18,000 additional long-term beds to these same for-profit corporations with the highest death rates. And these private for-profit long-term care facilities tend to be understaffed. What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, it's shocking. I mean, at this point, what Ontarians need to understand is that we're at a crossroads. There are anywhere between 35 and 45,000 new long-term care beds and long-term care beds that need to be rebuilt, put together. So licenses for more than 30,000 long-term care homes are coming to an end in 2025. All of those licenses are over. The beds need to be rebuilt. And the homes need to be rebuilt. And then there's 15,000 approximately new ones as well. So we're talking somewhere in the range of 45,000 new and rebuilt beds under new licenses. The public is paying to build them. We're paying through public funds for the building of these beds. So why would we not build them as public and not-for-profit, as opposed to building them for the for-profit industry that has such a hideous track record in Ontario and elsewhere, and is responsible for the deaths of so many thousands of people? It is inexplicable as public policy if one is looking at it from a public interest point of view. If one is looking at it from the interests of the for-profit long-term care chain companies, of course they would want that. And so therein lies the rub. I mean, that's what we're seeing. That is what is happening. And I should say that those 18,000 beds that they're in process of allocating to the for-profit homes, they're not done yet. Some of them are, but thousands of them are not done yet. This could be changed if Ontarians raise their voices and oppose vociferously the privatization for an entire new generation of long-term care beds that we're paying for anyway. You know, so we should run them in the public interest. The issue with the for-profits is that they have taken their profits. It's literally tens of millions of dollars per year per chain company, even while their residents died. 4,500 residents died of COVID, which is one of the worst records in the world. That's not normal. But in addition, it surely has to be thousands more died of neglect, of dehydration, of starvation, not even enough staff to feed them, to bathe them, to provide them with basic medical care that they needed in order to sustain their lives, let alone dignified lives, in just horrific conditions. And this after many, many years of poor conditions, inadequate care, worse inspection reports, you know, all kinds of major problems in an array of these for-profit homes.
Talking about inspections, I understand Ford has virtually done away with unannounced inspections, and that this year perhaps only 9 inspections were done across the province, and they were all forewarned of that visit.
This has been a point of contention for decades between the organizations representing residents and the public interest in long-term care and the for-profit industry. Starting under the Harris government, they canceled the surprise annual inspections. That was back in the 1990s. We fought very hard. We got them reinstated. Then they sort of fell by the wayside again. They weren't overtly canceled. We got them reinstated again. Then the Ford government came in 2018 and stopped all of this annual surprise inspections. Every long-term care home is supposed to be inspected yearly. It's supposed to be a surprise inspection. It's comprehensive. They ask residents an array of questions that are designed to uncover abuse and neglect and whether or not residents feel safe in the home and are getting the care that they're supposed to be getting. So all of those inspections have been now canceled for all of the years since the first year of the Ford government. They have repeatedly, under pressure, promised to reinstate them. They have not reinstated them. The latest thing that they did was they reduced the number of standards that the homes would be inspected against. So they created a new inspection system, and they said that they would bring them back in over 2 years. That was last fall, so that would take us well beyond the election. This is a point of contention because the industry, the for-profit industry, does not like surprise inspections, doesn't want them, and they win. I mean, they keep winning the removal of them. And despite all the PR and the rhetoric, no, they're not back. We don't have annual surprise inspections of the homes as we at minimum should. Literally thousands of people have died now in the last 2 years in long-term care, and we don't even have inspections back. How outrageous is that?
Under Mike Harris, the Conservatives also began privatizing home care. And that's the branch of healthcare that makes it possible for seniors to stay in their homes rather than going to long-term care. Harris introduced competitive bidding, which proved to be an abysmal failure, and eventually it was abandoned. However, in July of 2020, Ford passed Bill 175, privatizing the last parts of home care and reintroducing competitive bidding. How is this privatization going to impact home care workers and also their clients?
So in the summer of 2020, the Ford government passed Bill 175. Basically, what the bill does is it guts the existing home care legislation. What Mike Harris did, just jumping backwards for a minute, was he created a system to be able to invite in ParaMed and ComCare and all of the for-profits to bid against the Victorian Order of Nurses and St. Elizabeth and the VHA to try and take over home care contracts. So what Harris did was he created that, what is called competitive bidding system. That system was never really fundamentally changed. Competitive bidding was canceled because it was so destructive. What the Ford government has done is just completely gut the legislation covering home care. The way that things have been is that there is a publicly run, publicly operated governing body that provides an array of services and also runs the contracting out of services to the for-profits. They have now axed those, so there's no public governance left at all. They're in the process of eradicating them, and in the legislation, they're gone. And so what's going to happen is that the companies themselves will contract and subcontract all of that work with no oversight. There's no governance. There's no oversight. So basically what he's done is set up a system to privatize the last remaining public parts and the public oversight of home care. Home care has been a disaster for 20 years. This is, if you could conceive of a way to make it even worse and less accountable, this is it. It's unbelievable. So, you know, now if a new government is elected, they're going to have to recreate a home care system. It offers an opportunity, finally, to create a public not-for-profit home care system and end the terrible experiment that Harris foisted on the province of privatization. But at this point, what they've done is dismantle the remaining public governance and clear the way to privatize the whole thing and have it all contracted out among not-for-profit, some not-for-profits, and the majority for-profit companies after the election.
So really everything comes down to money, especially with Ford and his government. So let's look at Ontario's financial situation. In 2019, the gross domestic product for Ontario hit a historic high. In fact, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives said there was more money in the province than when Medicare was created. Yet on a per capita basis, Ontario has the lowest healthcare funding, lowest hospital funding, fewest hospital beds, and fewest nurses. This backlog of medical services that we've been talking about was actually manufactured over years by underfunding and cutting services. So there's a real disconnect happening for me, because on one hand, the Ontario government is strong, but on the other hand, there's very, very little political will to fund healthcare services under the PCs. So from where you stand, what's the solution?
I think there's two. One is, Ontario's governments have made a priority of giving tax cuts. So the Harris government cut more than $15 billion from public revenues in tax cuts for corporation and tax cuts that mostly benefit the wealthy. Then the Liberals came in. They actually increased funding in the first few years, and then they brought in a new slew of corporate tax cuts, which amount to something like minus $4 billion, maybe a bit more now. And then Ford came in and then brought in a whole new slew of cuts. So over the years, the Ontario governments have cut public funding for all of our public services by cutting taxes, primarily for corporations. And of course, tax cuts almost always benefit high-income people who pay more taxes. That's, you know, what it's supposed to be. The chief way that we mitigate income inequality is by taxing, and then that money is pooled and returned to us in income transfer programs, public services, and so on. And so it's a way of mitigating the increasing inequality of salaries and wages that are dished out by the private marketplace. And in Ontario, we've decided to do the opposite. We've decided to cut that and shunt that money back up to the wealthy and back to corporations and cut the public services that everyone needs. Ontario now funds all its public services at the lowest rate in the country, by far. We're not even close to the rest of the provinces. And in healthcare, we're at the bottom. We're paying the price of that. It's not that it's free. We're paying the price of that in lack of access to needed services and in costs for patients when they need care. And the bottom line is that we need to reverse that trend. We should be aiming towards being the average of Canada at the very least. That would be enough to fund the hospital services we need, the long-term care services we need, the home care services that we need, the community care and so on. I mean, without any question, it would make a huge leap forward for us. And it's not outrageous to ask for. We're not asking to be the top of the country. We're literally asking to be the middle of the country. But the other piece of it is that we have to stop privatizing. I mean, if you look at long-term care alone, tens of millions of dollars per month per chain are pulled out in profits rather than going to care. It makes no sense at all for us to be paying our public dollars to, you know, multinational investors who might live half a world away, who are agnostic as to whether the care of my mother or your father or grandfather is terrible. They're in it to take as much money out as possible. It's expensive. and it's costing in human lives and real human suffering.
We have a lot of listeners who would like to support the Ontario Health Coalition's campaign to stop healthcare privatization. What could listeners do?
Well, right now, as we head into the election, we're trying to set the key election issues. One is we have to stop the privatization of healthcare. We have to make that a key issue. We need to hold the Ford government accountable for what it's privatizing. We need to push the Liberals and the NDP to make clear, concrete promises, make it as difficult as possible for any of them to privatize were they to win the election. And so we're putting up lawn signs, window signs, billboards all across Ontario. There are local coalitions all across the province. There are citizens in towns where we don't have a local coalition that have agreed to have signs at their house if people want them. So people can just go onto our website, OntarioHealthCoalition.ca, you know, find the list and be able to get them. That's critical. Like for normal people to know, have a way to join and do something, it needs to be visible. They need to see that there's visible resistance. They need to have a way that they could do it. Everyone is able to do that. So that's crucial. And then as candidates go door to door, they know that these things are issues. They'll see the signs all over the place. They know they have to answer for them. It will be, and already we're being effective in creating the public debate about that. If we can create a public debate about the privatization of healthcare, there is no question we can win it. And the second issue, which is also featured in the signs and so on, is that we have to improve long-term care. We have to insist that care be provided to the elderly. What's happened in Ontario should be a blight on all of our consciences. Literally thousands of people have died and suffered in squalor. We have to win this one. This is our chance to do it. Public awareness has never been so high. So let's push it over the top. Let's make them accountable for what's happened so far. And let's win real change this time.
That was Natalie Mara, Executive Director of the Ontario Health Coalition, and Doreen Nickel in conversation. If you'd like to learn more about how to support the Ontario Health Coalition's campaign to end privatization in long-term care homes, please visit their website at OntarioHealthCoalition.ca. You can also check out Nickel's piece on Rabble.ca this week. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll be handing it off to Rabble's new editor, Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week on the site, Rabble founder and Canadian feminist leader Judy Rebick addressed the leaked U.S. Supreme Court decision that could overturn Roe v. Wade. Decided in 1973, Roe v. Wade affirmed a woman's right to have access to abortion services. The arguments against abortion as a constitutional right could be used against any right not originally in the Constitution, Rebick warns, thus threatening same-sex marriage, civil rights, and even potentially cross-racial marriage. In Canada, the Bloc Québécois tabled a unanimous consent motion in the House of Commons on Tuesday, asking that its members affirm the freedom of choice for abortion. The Conservative Party of Canada, while instructing its members not to comment on the abortion issue, did see some members vote against the Bloc motion. Also this week, Stephen Wentzel covered the reaction to the official repeal of the so-called gay blood ban. The discriminatory ban, first introduced in 1992 at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, imposed a lifetime ban on men who have sex with men from donating blood in Canada. By relying on unsupported science to determine donor eligibility, the ban not only harmed gay men, but also Canadians in emergency care who were needlessly put at further risk of not getting life-saving transfusions. The Liberal Party under Justin Trudeau promised to repeal the ban during the 2015 election campaign, and again in 2019. Instead of celebrating this moment in Canadian history, I'm simply left saying, it's about time, said Chris O'Coin, executive director of the AIDS Coalition of Nova Scotia, in reaction to the news. Meanwhile, I covered the release of the Department of Defense Ministerial Advisory Panel report on extremism, racism, and prejudice in the Canadian Forces. Number 5 of the 13 recommendations in the report deals directly with white supremacy. The defense team is not immune to infiltration by these extremist groups, and some units and departments may be even more vulnerable given their isolation from large metropolitan areas, the report reads. The report goes on to recommend that the forces take steps to remove white supremacists from their ranks by identifying them early on during the recruitment process. Dr. Barbara Perry, director of the Center on Hate, Bias, and Extremism at Ontario Tech University, was underwhelmed by the report, but did see one silver lining. "We at least have a policy on right-wing extremism, so that is some progress," she said. Finally this week, Carl Nirenberg kicked off our coverage of the Ontario provincial election by comparing the priorities of the ruling Conservative Party in their recently announced budget to the platform of the official opposition, NDP. While the NDP emphasizes providing a hand up to the most vulnerable, protecting the environment, and dealing with the backlogs in healthcare and weaknesses of long-term care for the elderly, the Conservatives put their greatest emphasis on big spending on infrastructure and grants, subsidies, and tax breaks for private industry, writes Nirenberg. "We will be providing coverage throughout the 2022 provincial election leading up to the day Ontarians head to the polls on June 2nd. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Last month, Rabble.ca celebrated its 21st anniversary. If you're a fan of the show and would like to celebrate with us, we'd love you to consider making a donation. We're only $7,000 away from our target goal of raising $21,000 in 21 days. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please visit the link in our description to donate. Or if you're listening on the radio, check out Rabble.ca for more information. And lastly, don't miss it. Our next Off the Hill event is happening Tuesday, May 17th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. May's panel will be co-hosted by Libby Davies and Robin Brown and will feature MP Leah Gazan. Additional guests to be announced. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Stephen Wenzel, Carl Nirenberg, and Nick Seabrook for their reporting this week, and to Carl, too, for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. Shout out to the listeners at UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba this week. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.